Welcome to episode 2 of Old Stories, New Information. I'm your host, Brent Colley, joined this week by friend and fellow historian, Tim Abbott. As we noted in episode 1, the concept of the series is to share new information on topics randomly discovered, deemed interesting, and then further explored. So Tim and I have worked together for over a decade on topics tied to history, government, and open spaces, and I'm very pleased that his schedule has allowed him to be with us today. Welcome,
Tim. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I, too, have enjoyed our shared passion for uncovering the history of our region and re-examining some of what we think we know about it.
No doubt. So what we're going to be talking about today is how we found about the Hessians and their march and the time that they spent here in the northwest corner. You found it a different way than I, but how did you find it?
Well, it's interesting. There's a monument on Sand Road in North Canaan that caught my eye, and it was erected to commemorate what is claimed to be the longest march of the Revolutionary War. And these were prisoners from Burgoyne's army, captured, or rather surrendered, after the battles of Saratoga. And a year after that came through our region, being shifted to a safer theater of the war for internment in Virginia. And it was that caught my interest and made me say, wait, what do we know about these people? How could this have been a major event during the war in our area? And I hadn't heard about it. And that started me down a long path.
Interesting. Well, my path was a little bit easier. I was involved with the Sharon Historical Society. And in a book that we had on file, there was a map of South Main Street, which runs basically from the clock tower down to Amenia. And on that map was labeled Hessian Fields. And that's between roughly 33 and 65 South Main Street. So that's 4 miles from Amenia. So I just Googled it because that's what we do in the present day, right?
Of course.
And sure enough, there's your research from 2011.
Yeah. It's also one of those topics that occasionally gets assigned to students in history classes at our regional high school. Go find a local historic site and write about it. And so once I did my research, I had more students contacting me about it.
No, it's great. And then you worked with Nick Bellantoni, who I have as well. And he had, I think you said he had a pretty big impact on this.
It was, yes, he was our former state archaeologist, as you know, and the more I dug into the story and started realizing that it's a much more interesting and complicated one, but also one where if we start using translations of the German journals that were kept by that segment of the prisoners, we can pinpoint with pretty great accuracy where some of their encampments were as they passed through the state. So that's how I reached out to Nick, and then took him to some of the places that we had documented.
That makes it fun. And that was what stood out to me about your research, because I had different knowledge of the war. And
sure,
that moment in time of the Revolutionary War was a big time for change.
Yeah, let's set the stage.
You layered something so much bigger onto that picture, which makes, like you said, that march so much more significant, because at that moment in time, we were transitioning and bringing in not only the French, but also changing that the way we did the Revolutionary War. So
that's exactly right
to me.
What happened in 1778, a year after these men were surrendered under something called the Saratoga Convention, was that it became a global war. And as you said, France was now actively an ally, not just sending us supplies. This threatened Britain's empire well beyond the 13 rebellious colonies. And it suddenly meant that over 5,000 prisoners held in eastern Massachusetts were vulnerable to recapture. It meant that those, I will call them German because almost none of them were Hessians. Most of them were Brunswickers. But those German and British prisoners of Burgoyne's army were suddenly a liability and needed to be shifted. And the idea was that the militia would have the responsibility of escorting them through the various states on a march from eastern Massachusetts through Connecticut and across all the way down to Charlottesville, Virginia.
But it wasn't necessarily a moving jail, right?
No, it wasn't. In some degree, you can tell that because of how many men slipped away along the march. Men in that army, and it also included women and children, which I know we wanted to talk about, but they were moved in groups of about 600 a day. And at this time, there were 4,200 left. So that's six different divisions of men who are meant to be marched a certain period of time and then in camp in barns or in fields while their officers are billeted in surrounding houses. The idea was that as one division moved on, another would camp at its same site. But this required a lot of logistics. It required the local militia to serve as escorts and guards. It required requisitioning wagons and places for feeding and accommodating these prisoners. But they weren't chained, right? It wasn't a closely guarded group. It was, however, a vulnerable population that needed to be shifted through efficiently. And more or less, that is what happened.
Huh. Okay. So they're in the Boston area, and then they start making their way down towards our neck of the woods, so to speak, so the northwest corner of Connecticut.
Yeah, it's a northern route, right?
So I know that they, you know, it seemed as if the fall months were when they made that transition.
They did it in the fall because the roads were so bad. They really wanted the roads to freeze. And if you think about it, 600 people a day plus escorts plus wagons will make a mess of a colonial road. And in fact, some of the journals that survive from this long journey talk about just a terrible condition and how they were happy, actually, when the mud was frozen solid and not happy when it wasn't. They took a northern route through the state. If you're familiar with the Rochambeau Trail, it's much more southerly. And that's because New York City is still occupied, and the lower Westchester Valley is disputed territory. And so the idea was they would cross at Dobbs Ferry on the Hudson River, and by the time they got to Sharon, having entered the state in Enfield, the Connecticut militia would hand them over to the New York militia. That's not actually what happened. There was no New York militia there to pick them up, so they piled up in Sharon. Your Hessian Field didn't have 600 people a night in it. It had 4,000 by the end.
That's crazy. It's but like I said, it wasn't a jail. Like, they had, in your research, you found that they actually had several balls here or dances in Salisbury and Sharon.
Yeah, they had them in Canaan, they had them in Salisbury, they had them in Sharon, they had them in Suffield. And this is not the enlisted men, but the officers absolutely were a spectacle, particularly the German ones. As an aside, very few of the British participants in this march left a record of their observations. For them, they are prisoners of war and in an area that they would be, some of them, familiar with. But for the Germans, everything was new. So they wrote a lot, and they wrote their impressions of the towns they were going through, what they thought of the women in those towns, the entertainments that they had, and they were something of a spectacle as well, as these foreign troops who had come to wage war in this land, but who were now fairly complacent prisoners. So yeah, they were the event of the season in the towns that they passed through, and were even remembered by a future governor who was a young boy in Sharon and remarked late in life that he recalled following the German troops as they finally marched into New York, singing their devotional songs, right, the psalms of the Lutherans or of the Catholics, if that's where they had come from.
Yeah, that's a great story. My all-time favorite, though, is the story of the ball in Salisbury, where they note that there was 24 bells locally, and that they danced very well until the morning. And what really tied into that, that made it fun, was that in your research you found that 50 English, 30 Brunswickers, and 22 Hessians dessert, like, in our area. So,
yes. Yeah, they lost a fair number as they were coming through. And, in fact, in some of the towns around here, there are graves of some of those soldiers, extending actually up into Massachusetts as well. People made lives. There's at least one I know of who was in Norfolk. There's at least one who was in Salisbury. It became interesting. The solution to moving them into New York required that they send for Continental troops to come up from what's now Putnam County, down in the Patterson area, to escort them over the line. And those troops were Pennsylvanians. They were Anthony Wayne's people. And 500 of them made the march up. Wayne sending a letter to the Continental Dragoon, who was in charge of trying to escort these guys, saying, "I see that the militia of Connecticut are but a militia. I send you soldiers," which wasn't very fair to the Connecticut militia, who had not agreed to go outside the boundaries of their state and did a perfectly good job, runaways notwithstanding, moving the Brunswickers and the British prisoners through as far as they had.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I mean, 4,000 people just stuck here in Sharon. I'd imagine they would take old Route 22 or something along those lines to get down into those areas.
Paul? I think they probably got the Armenia Union on the way out, or that where that is now. That's more likely. They were going to a place called Nine Partners over in Dutchess County, which is the patent that's very near the state lines. And there were a couple hundred women and children there, too, because armies of the day had soldiers' wives and their families as an expected part of it. And they were both German and English. And they, too, went on to internment in Virginia and elsewhere. Some of these soldiers were still prisoners near the end of the war. Some of them had enlisted into the Continental Army. Many of them did not return to Europe after the war. At least 5,000 total of the Hessian and other German soldiers who were contracted to serve here at various times in among these prisoners and others stayed and became part of the fabric of our country.
So what do you feel needs to be explored next? I mean, we've talked about the length and the significance. My background is where I grew up in Reading, Connecticut, so I knew there was three different encampments in Reading, forming a crescent shape around New York City. And as you mentioned, you know, we're heading over the Hudson, which had other troops. And is there anything that really stands out to you that hasn't been explored that should be?
Surrounding this episode, there's always more to learn. One can follow up on who the individual militia soldiers were from our towns who were part of those escorts. I have found some receipts for cartridges issued to them and payment for a troop of 12 dragoons and things like that. So we can flesh out what it actually meant in these communities to be responsible for these prisoners as they came through. We can also, there's some questions I haven't been able to answer. Here's one of them, and it relates to Reading. There was a brief period in Connecticut when it was not just militia who were escorting, but also General Poor's Brigade, which were New Hampshire troops and also a Canadian regiment. They were only involved for a brief segment of the march, and they were at Washington's insurance policy because he wasn't sure that the militia were up to the task. They escorted the 5th of the 6 divisions, this one almost entirely German, from Simsbury to Norfolk. And then they got orders to go to Reading for their encampment. And so they marched that way. And there's a journal that was kept by a lieutenant named Blake in the 1st New Hampshire who said that when they got to New Milford, they turned over their German prisoners. What German prisoners? They shouldn't have had any at that time. They should have left them in Norfolk. So were they picking up some of the runaways? You know, had they had a few who went with them? I don't know. It's a mystery. It's something for us to look at.
No, that's why it's such a fun topic. And also, what you've touched on in your documentary is that they took all these different routes. So not everyone came through the same roads, so it must have been for the locals something of great interest because they came.
You would think so. And so where are the letters? Where are the contemporary letters that said, today 600 enemy soldiers came through our town and we entertained them? They're very, very few votes. The problem is we don't know local contemporary accounts about what people thought as these soldiers were coming through. We have their memories late in life. We have an occasional record by a soldier applying for a pension in the 1830s who said that he was part of the escort. But what we do not have, and you'd think we would, right, would be people writing letters from our area to their friends saying, you wouldn't believe what came through town. It should have been like the circus. And maybe it was. Maybe there are documents and accounts like that that await to be discovered.
No, it's true. And, you know, for the listeners, that's pretty much, we'll probably circle back to this one because there is so much to unpack within it. We've set up stories at robinhoodradio.com that allow you to email us and, you know, let us know what you found interesting or what you want to know more about. That's the whole interactive part of this that makes it even more fun. But as noted, you know, old stories, new information. The new information is always coming in, and it alters what we know, but it also makes it of interest to just anyone. I mean, history grows, and when we find new primary sources, things really get exciting for the historians. So
I quite agree.
Thank you so much for sharing this knowledge with us today. It was
my pleasure,
as always, speaking with you.
I'm looking forward to the next topic, whatever that might be. It doesn't have to stay in the 18th century, as you know.
That's the thing, too, and that's really what the theme is. The next episode, what we're going to share with the listeners is what was found in the second floor of the Sharon Valley Tavern back in the 1980s. That greatly expanded what we know about the workings of the iron industry here in the northwest corner of Connecticut. It's a fascinating topic that we know you'll enjoy. So until next time, be well. Always do right, because that will gratify some people and astonish the rest. And enjoy your week.
Can't wait. Thanks, everyone.
Old Stories, New Information, hosted by Brett Colley, is produced at the facilities of WHDD, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.